Red Strings and Superstition. Yes, that is our session for today. In our first session, we talked about Kabbalah as a received tradition that seeks to explain how the universe works on a spiritual level. We talked about the idea that the universe is created in order to enable benefit to the creatures who inhabit there as they grow towards God and they contribute to the universe around them. We talked about the belief in reincarnation last week and how it stems partly from the challenge of theodicy, the problem of people suffering when they don't appear to deserve it, the problem of people benefiting, frankly, when they don't appear to deserve it, as well as the appeal of second chances. And we discussed the question of, so is this a Jewish idea or is this something that was sort of grafted in from the outside? That was all last week. What I want to do today is talk about the belief in a red string, where it comes from within Judaism, and what it says sort of about contemporary spirituality and the revived interest in Kabbalah. So what better place to go for this conversation than the website of the Kabbalah Center, where they have multiple pages that are dedicated to the red string, and I brought you an excerpt in source number one. It begins with a quote from the Zohar, which says, "A person possessed of an evil eye carries with him jealousy and envy, a destroying force. Be on your guard not to come near him. He may injure you." Okay. And then their commentary. Scary as it may sound, the Zohar says that the eyes are the windows of the soul and therefore can transmit tremendous energy. When we look at others with hate or with envy, we are sending a negative energy their way, and vice versa. The red string protects us from conscious and unconscious stares. It is worn on the left wrist, left representing the desire to receive, therefore creating a protective shield that fends off negative energy. We're going to have to come back to this whole thing, but I want to just read it through first. It is an ancient tradition to wind a red string 7 times around the tomb of Rachel, the great matriarch. By wearing the red string on our left wrist, we can receive a vital connection to the protective energies surrounding the tomb of Rachel. It also allows us to take Rachel's powerful protective energy with us and draw from it any time. Kabbalists believe that by seeking the light of holy persons such as Rachel, we can use their powerful influence to assist us. According to Kabbalah, Rachel represents the physical world in which we live. Her greatest desire is to protect and defend all of her children from evil. When we tie the red string to our left wrist while reciting the powerful Ana B'Koach prayer, we seal her powerful protective energy within as it intercepts negative influences intended to cause us harm. And they go on. They talk about how you wrap it, you have a friend wrap it around, and then you tie 7 knots, and then an additional prayer, which can be found on the package that they, send you the red string with. One might think that with all of this power behind it to support and help people, and with our mission in the world being to help other people, that it would just be available free of charge. However, in order to make this work, you can see in source number 2, I brought you the price list. Red string package, $26. Book hardback, $9.95. The DVD, $9.95. The book in Farsi is $10. I don't know what the extra 5 cents are for. Yeah, it's for Iranians. That's the only translation that they're marketing there on the site. There's English and there's Farsi. I don't know what this says. Actually, I do know what this says. But I guess there's a sense that Persians are more likely to believe in this and therefore have it appeal to them, and so they're going to specifically market it in Farsi. I assume that's where that's where the logic is. Oh boy, this gives me a headache. So. Yeah. Okay. So there you go.
Why is it red?
Why is it red? Why is it a string? Why Rachel's tomb? What in the world is all of this about? So, the truth is they go into a little bit on their site the idea of colors and each color having a certain significance and red reflecting power, and they actually have a little bit of a discussion there on their site, but all of this is frankly somewhat strange to me. meaning what they're presenting here is that the eye transmits energy from the soul, that the string on the left, since the left is the aspect that receives, so a string on the left will block that reception. I'm guessing a thick bracelet probably would do it too, like Wonder Woman. I'm being too sarcastic, I apologize. The string is wound around Rachel's tomb. Now, what they're drawing on here are real themes within Judaism. They're taking real ideas. So, for example, the idea that the left receives and the right gives is actually an idea that's found traditionally within Judaism and within mysticism. The idea of Rachel as a protector of her children is an ancient idea within Judaism. The prophet Jeremiah speaks of Rachel crying for her children. And the sages in very early Midrash speak about God listening to the prayers of Rachel on behalf of her descendants. So they're taking ideas that are sound, well-founded ideas within Judaism and weaving them together to create what they claim is an ancient practice. Now, the idea that in ancient times they were wrapping strings around the tomb of Rachel, no. If you had a photograph of Jews from any period before the Kabbalah Center, you would not see pictures of large populations of Jews wearing strings that have been wrapped around Rachel's tomb. Frankly, there's a lot of debate as to whether that is Rachel's tomb or not. You know, somewhere they're wrapping strings around some other tomb, and somebody who's buried inside there was wondering what in the world is going on. Why does this appeal to people? Because it does appeal to people. Without a doubt, it appeals to people. I went on a mission with Federation when I was in my shul in Pennsylvania. I went on a few missions with them, but I remember one in particular where we went to the Kotel, we went to the Western Wall, and there was, there were many, but there was one in particular, an elderly woman who was selling these red strings, and there were people throwing money at her, and it's not as though they were giving money to everybody who was in need there, but they went to her and they gave her significant sums of money to get these red strings. Why? And you're not talking about... some of the people who were doing this were traditional. Some of the people who were doing this were people who frankly were there because of Israel. Israel resonated with them, but in terms of Judaism as a religion, maybe you'd see them in shul on Rosh Hashanah, maybe not. But the red string they had to have. Why? What is it about the string? Yeah.
Can't hurt.
Well, lots of things can't hurt. Going to shul on Rosh Hashanah, well, depending on how long it is. You know. Yes?
Red string.
You've got a red string. The red string, live and in person.
I have one too.
And it's on the left hand. It's on the left.
Yeah.
Okay, you're good.
I have another.
Okay, but that's not red.
You'd imagine how much you
need. Oh, there you go. I was like, okay. Okay, we have red strings in the room today. Yes? How is it a tie to their parents if their parents didn't have red strings?
It has nothing to do with the actual red string.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there are lots of New Yorkers who are worried that it's called a canary, which is the term for a canary or a
hen. I've never heard them use canary for that. That's interesting.
I had a mother-in-law who always spoke about canaries.
See, I always said, you come to teach, you end up learning. Now I learn about canaries. Yeah.
But there weren't a memory from a grandmother or...
Right. There was a range of ages. One person in particular I'm thinking of was probably about 35 at the time.
Sometimes it's just a link to the past and be careful. And it's the whole Jewish thing of converting unwanted gazes that could create problems.
Okay. Diane.
Is it any different than having an amulet wearing a chavsa, putting a bead on your child?
Good. So Diane points out a potential bridge. I'm going to come back to the mezuzah case in a moment. Yeah. Well, the eye, the chamsa with the eyes, you can combine the powers.
To those ladies, you get the red string with the eye.
Oh, okay. So you have to know, you need a more elaborate price list. They should have a website. So I want to go back to Diane's point about kissing the mezuzah, because that's actually a perfect example, sort of a missing link in the evolution. In the sense that there are many Jewish practices that are straightforward as Jewish law, that are anchored in biblical text, like having a mezuzah on your door, the biblical text. You shall write these words and you shall place them on the doorposts. That's very simple and straightforward. And then you find, to take the mezuzah example, you find that transition into what becomes for many people a good luck charm. So if somebody becomes ill in the house, we have to check the mezuzah. Right? It's like, you know, you probably heard that. Or there are stories about Kabbalists who travel from town to town, and they will read people's mezuzahs, and strange things will happen. They can tell you bizarre things about people's homes, and I know of stories like that.
I gave you a mezuzah last week.
That's true, although there
somebody
was...
somebody who was ill.
Yeah.
And I changed your mezuzah. Could hurt. That,
yeah.
That thing, it could hurt.
Well, there also, there was a problem with the mezuzah.
There was a problem with that mezuzah, but did it change her health?
Right.
Make
right. No, but I know of a case where a close relative of mine, who I trust without any doubt, who is not into all of this, went to one of these traveling fellows and was asked to bring somebody else's mezuzah in, because the person who had it didn't want to bring it themselves, but they wanted to know what they would say. And so this relative of mine brought the mezuzah in, showed it to him, and this Kabbalist reads the mezuzah, and you know the text of mezuzah is supposed to be, you know, the same everywhere, and and tells them, this isn't your mezuzah. That's number one. Number two, the people who are in the house are trying to have children and are not able to do so, and it's because one member of the couple isn't Jewish. Three for three. Three for three. So, I don't believe it, but I know the story from someone who was in it first. You know, I'm secondhand. You're hearing it secondhand, but I heard it firsthand. Bizarre to me.
But was it really true?
Yes, three for three. All those things were correct. Yes, Rochelle. You were going to say? Okay. So, these stories are out there, but I want to go back a step to kissing the mezuzah. Because kissing the mezuzah is part of a set of mezuzah-related practices which have, on one hand, a pedigree, and on the other hand, a big question mark. So, the origin of kissing the mezuzah is simply to show love for the mitzvah. That's what it is. The same way you kiss the Torah when the Torah goes around. So you kiss the Torah, so you kiss the mezuzah as well. It's a text of the Torah. It shows love for the mitzvah. Maimonides says, when you walk through a doorway, you're supposed to notice the mezuzah. You look at it, because it's supposed to be a reminder of God. That's what it's for. He doesn't say, you should kiss it. But what's wrong with kissing it? Nothing, until it becomes a good luck charm. And it ceases to be a mitzvah, and it ceases to remind us of God and those things, that the themes that are represented within the mezuzah. It stops being a mezuzah, effectively, and it becomes something else. So that there was a period in Jewish history in which people would actually inscribe incantations on the scroll of the mezuzah. And Maimonides weighs in and says, don't do that. You've corrupted the mezuzah. You've turned it into a good luck charm. He views that as quasi-idolatrous. On the other hand, if you were to take a traditional mezuzah, you would find on the outside of the scroll written the following words in Hebrew. Kuzu b'mechzas kuzu. Now, Hebrew speakers, does that mean anything in Hebrew? No, it does not mean anything in Hebrew. You know how you get the text? You take the letters of Hashem, Elohim, Hashem, the Hashem being the four-letter name, Yud, Dalet, Vav, and Dalet, or Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey, and you add one, you go one letter ahead in the alphabet. So Yud becomes Kaf, Hey becomes Vav, and so on through it, and you get Kuzu, b'machzas Kuzu, that's Hashem, Elohim, Hashem. Why is that on the outside of my mezuzah? The Torah never, ever, ever says to do that. Nonetheless, despite Maimonides' opposition to writing incantations on the inside, it became traditional for people to write this on the outside of the parchment. And it's there. I could take the mezuzahs here off the door and show them to you. You'll see it. You would see it there. The Talmud has a story, a classic story of one of the sages portraying the mezuzah as an emblem of divine protection for those in the home. You won't find that in the Torah's account of what a mezuzah is. The idea that it's divine protection, any more than doing any mitzvah, provides protection. Nonetheless, mezuzah acquires layers like this, which start out in a very innocent way, kiss the mezuzah, show love for the mitzvah, and then migrate to become something else. And that's I like the example, and I wish I had thought of it, I would have put it on the sheet. But that's actually a perfect example of exactly what happened regarding the evil eye and the red string. Now, we could spend forever on the evil eye. There are texts upon texts upon texts that have been written about the evil eye in Judaism and beyond, because it's certainly not exclusively ours. Many cultures have a concept of the evil eye. There was one book that I came across online in preparing this, and I didn't have time to really draw on it and read it through, but it's by a woman named Rivka Ulmer, and the title is The Evil Eye in the Bible and in Rabbinic Literature. It's a very interesting read, at least the parts of it that I saw. But let's go back to the core of this and what evil eye is about. And I think that will help explain some of why this resonates with people today. Take a look at source number 3, please, which is the earliest biblical reference to an evil eye, and it doesn't look like anything we are familiar with. This is after Sarah says that Abraham should evict his son Ishmael from the home. Right? Abraham and Sarah were not able to have children. Abraham takes his maid Hagar at Sarah's insistence to become his concubine. Sarah says she should actually be his full wife. And so he ends up marrying her. She is able to conceive. She takes Sarah lightly. There's a whole clash between Sarah and Hagar. Ultimately, Hagar has a son. His name is Ishmael. He grows up and is 14 years old when his half-brother, Yitzchak, Isaac, is born. He is some kind of a threat to his half-brother, and at the age of 17, he is kicked out of the house. Sarah says, let him leave the house. He is a threat to his baby brother. Abraham does not like this idea at all. And this is his verdict. On it, take a look at number 3. In the Hebrew, it's Vayera Hadavar Ma'od Be'enei Avraham. The matter was very evil in Abraham's eye because of his son. Whether that's his son who he has to kick out, or whether it's because of the son who is being protected, an interesting question, but not for right now. But that's the first usage of the phrase, evil eye. What does it connote here? Jealous? In what sense, what would he be jealous of?
I think it was a threat to him.
A threat to him how? I mean, evicting his son doesn't...
The child is a bad influence, I understand, on the other child. So
yeah.
I think that's angry. Sarah saw that and she wanted to...
Right, but this is... But this is Abraham's disapproval of her plan.
Right.
This is... Right. So, but it's not a jealous reaction, I think. He wants to protect his son. He wants to protect Ishmael as well as, you know, Yitzhak, Isaac in this story. But to me, this is disapproval. Right? He looks on it negatively. Yeah.
It's evil in his eye, and the eye is the window to the soul. So
when it says it's evil in his eye, what it means is it's evil in his opinion. This is how he feels about it. Right? Keep in mind that all through Bereishit, all through Genesis, when you see something, that expresses not simply perception, but comprehension. How you feel about it. So in in creation, every day it says God saw this and it was good. It's not about perceiving it; it's about comprehending it and rendering a verdict on it. Diana.
What does it say? What kind of empathy? Because that's the first example of jealousy.
Right, it doesn't use that expression at all. No, it just says that God turns to Hevel's offering, and then it says that Cain was angry.
So there's no I in it.
There's
not a consequence.
No, no. It just says by Yiplupanav, his face fell. That's it. Take a look at number 4, please. This is a more familiar use of it from Deuteronomy. This is talking about lending to people in need at a time when, if you lend to them, you may not get paid back because of the law of Shemitah that every 7 years, loans that are already due and have not been paid back, that loans where the borrower has defaulted, simply become nullified. So it says here, be careful, lest your eye be evil against your brother, the pauper, such that you will not give to him. Vera'ah, with an ayin, vera'ah einecha be'achicha ha'evyon. Your eye will be ra, ayin ra, ayin hara, that's where it comes from in the Hebrew. Ayin means eye, ra means bad. So your eye will be evil against your brother. Is that like the evil eye we're familiar with? In what sense? It's not disapproval now.
Because it's animosity. Anything can happen if you don't repay them, like Shakespeare said it in another way.
Yeah. Animosity? Okay. I would look at it more as an unwillingness to help. Right? It's someone who says, I don't want to assist. Another example, in source number 5, this comes from a passage in which the Jews are warned that terrible things will happen to them if they rebel against the laws they've been given, and how they will suffer, and in their suffering, one person will turn against the other. And the text says, the eye of the soft, highly pampered man among you will be evil against his brother, wife, and remaining children. So it describes how he will not be willing to help those who had been closest to him. It's an act of withholding. Take a look at number 6, the last example I'm going to show you. There are many more. Do not dine on the bread of one whose eye is evil. Meaning, if you have somebody who doesn't really want to invite you to eat, right? But you're going to come in anyway. Don't do it. Don't eat from his bread because he's going to resent what you're doing. He's going to resent having helped you. So here what we're seeing is that the evil eye is much more about hostility and much more about withholding assistance from others. Are we clear? Is that coming through in the examples that I'm giving? There are more examples that one could give. It's not that far to take it from there to envy, to being jealous of others, which is the way people usually think of the evil eye. If you take a look at source number 7, there's a very interesting paper. I don't really recommend it, but it's an interesting paper anyway. By a fellow named Alan Dundies. It's called Wet and Dry, The Evil Eye. You can find it online. In which he says there is no question that envy is somehow closely related to the evil eye. He's not talking Jewish specifically. He deals with a range of cultures in which it appears. The wet and dry association is because he notes that in many cultures, being given the evil eye is said to cause the drying up of bodily fluids. Everything from the milk of a nursing mother to other liquids within the body. So he says, this is clear in the earliest Near Eastern texts we have. The word envy is etymologically derived from the Latin invidia, which in turn comes from invidere. Thus, ultimately, from to see, or seeing, as Cicero first observed. So he associates the word for envy with sight. That's the idea. Yes?
Think of lamp, her weak eyes.
What would you do with that?
Well,
it's true that she's described as having a weak or soft eye, but what would you do with it?
Well, because you talk about, you just mentioned evil eye, weak eye, wet eyes, dry eyes. We often talk about Leah's eyes
Interesting. But it doesn't go anywhere near evil, as far as I can recall at any point. Interesting. So envy and associating it with the soft eye? It's an interesting idea. I don't know what to do with it, but it's an interesting idea. Yeah. Okay. Need to be more creative. So what we get here is the idea that the evil eye expresses some kind of malignance in the relationship between people, which may start in one place in terms of distance between them, unwillingness to help, but you can easily see where the envy association would fit in. Now go back to look at number one again and what the Kabbalah Center says, and you realize they're not far off. I mean, the piece from the Zohar fits in very well, which shouldn't be a surprise. A person possessed of an evil eye carries with him jealousy and envy, a destroying force. Be on your guard not to come near him. We still have to talk about how that becomes injury. We didn't get there yet. But the eyes, they talk about as the windows of the soul. You look at others with hate, with envy. You're sending a negative energy their way. Well, let's see what Judaism traditionally did with this idea of a dangerously evil eye. The sages of the Babylonian Talmud, there's actually a distinction to be drawn potentially between the two Talmuds. We've talked about before how the Talmud gets written down. It actually gets written down in two different periods of time, in two different places. We talked about how it was verbal and then eventually there was a need to write it down. The Jews living in Israel, specifically centered around Sipori, near the Kinneret, near the Sea of Galilee, they record the Mishnah there. That's the core text of the Talmud that all Jews get. But then, the Jews who are based there write a Talmud expanding on the Mishnah, and the Jews living in exile in Babylon write their own Talmud somewhat later. There's a lot of debate about exactly what each group had access to in terms of the scholarship of the others. There's a lot to be said about that. But you find a strong tendency in the Babylonian version of the Talmud to look at the evil eye in a remarkably rational way. Not as the eye is channeling energy from your soul and sending negative waves to the other person, but rather, when someone looks at somebody else in an evil way, that's going to motivate them to act against the other person. It's fairly simple and straightforward. If you arouse somebody's jealousy, expect that that's going to lead to something. It isn't simply going to stay as an emotion on their part. If you take a look at source number 8, you find it associated with jealousy in particular, this evil eye. This is from Pirkei Avot in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehoshua taught, evil eye, evil desire, and hatred of others remove a person from this world. He says a person is going to spend his time being jealous of what others have, or being angry of about the conduct of other people, is going to ultimately be removed from this world, not in the sense that they die from the experience, but in the sense that they eat themselves up. They consume themselves with their anger and their outrage and their indignation that other people have what they don't have. If you take a look at number 9, Maimonides comments on this Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, and he says, what are we talking about here when we say evil eye, evil desire, hatred of others? He says, desire for wealth, excess of desire, and an evil spirit. When Maimonides writes evil spirit, he doesn't mean, you know, thing that's floating around out there and can possess somebody. Maimonides very clearly discusses evil spirit as an evil mood, something that takes over one's person. He actually uses the term melancholy, depression in other words. And he talks about that at some length in a variety of places. If you take a look at number 10, also Pirkei Avot, one who has an evil eye, haughty spirit, and broad, meaning complacent soul, is of the students of wicked Bilam. Bilam is the one in the Torah who tries to curse the Jews, who tries to inspire divine anger against the Jews. It's ultimately all about this kind of jealousy of others. Now, jealousy in and of itself leads to what kind of, obviously leads to negative interactions, but what kind of actions result from one person being jealous of another? What do jealous people do? Right, they might speak harmfully about others in an attempt to undermine them.
But they suffer too.
They do suffer, but right now I'm talking about what they do aggressively. Sorry? Physical harm, quite possibly. Economic, right? They might try to
undermine the other person, reduce the other person.
They try to undermine and reduce the other person. Are any of these supernatural? No, they're relatively straightforward. However, the Talmud does have a supernatural concern. Take a look at source number 11, where it speaks about it. One who passes judgment to God regarding another person will himself be punished first. Meaning, if somebody is jealous of another person and says, why do they deserve to have what they have? And they're motivated. They turn to God and they say, God, why did they get what they got? So the Talmud says, they themselves are going to be judged first. God is going to say, well, let me open your books, you know, and see how you're doing and see whether you deserve what you have. But implicit within it is a frightening message. Because what else is going to happen? Read it through carefully. What is it saying is going to happen when one person passes judgment to God about another?
They'll be punished,
and what else?
First
meaning that there's a second. That there is another who can also suffer. In other words, what this passage in the Talmud is suggesting is that while this is a very bad idea, a human being could turn to God and say, hey, why do they deserve what they got? And that God will open the books and say, let me see. That's a scary concept. That's a very difficult concept. Meaning, until somebody had this evil eye, God was just fine with the idea that somebody had something they didn't deserve. Somebody then, you know, you sort of think of like, it's like you know, calling the CRA on somebody. Right? They weren't going to audit them, but now you said something. Now, okay, now we're going to do an audit and see what they deserve and what they're getting. Take a look at number 12, which actually speaks about it in a very it recognizes the authority or the power that a human being has to do this. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel taught, wherever scholars have turned their eyes, meaning turned their eyes in judgment, death or poverty has ensued. There really is a belief that a human being is able to call in judgment on somebody else. So while we have these rational applications of the evil eye, when a person has animosity towards somebody else, they may act in a certain way towards them, speech, competition, physical harm, whatever it is, there's also this idea that somebody on a spiritual level can actually turn to God and say, so why did this person get what they deserved? Yeah. Or what they didn't deserve. Yeah.
The first few ideas where the evil eye harms the person who has it.
Yeah.
Or causes withdrawal of help is one thing. But the idea that you can have an evil effect in the rest of the world sounds perilously close to witchcraft. And aren't we forbidden from consulting with witches and using their powers?
So Nancy raises a really good question. Isn't this like witchcraft?
Or believing in it.
Right.
Or idolatry of some kind.
Right. I mean, we are talking about, let's be clear, because we use the phrase to have an evil eye, and it really refers to the person who is looking in an evil way or the person who is looked upon in an evil way. We're focusing here really on the harm to the recipient, so to speak, although we've noted that there will be harm to the person who issues it as well. But what would be the difference between witchcraft and this? Or is there no difference? What do you think? Yeah, it is. It's not like a curse. It is a curse. So what's the difference?
To me, it's the same. The anti-God behavior is the opposite of Judaism. This is talking about Judaism and how God will punish.
Right.
It does refer to God.
Right. I think the fundamental difference is that the witchcraft which the Torah prohibits is one which turns to other forces. As a matter of fact, anybody know the word in Hebrew for witchcraft? You do know it. A lot of you know it. But you know it in Yiddish, but it's from the Hebrew. Right? The word in Yiddish for a witch is? Machshefa, right? Machshefa. That's from the Hebrew. Mechashefa is the term in Hebrew for a witch. So, the Talmud has a play on words. It says the term kshafim, which is the word for witchcraft, stands for makrishin pamalia shalmala. That won't be on the final. You don't need to write it down. The makrishin pamalia shalmala, which means those who would work against divine forces. It's an anti-God type of an approach. Whereas what we're presenting here says, I believe in God, and I believe that God is able to affect the world, and I'm appealing to God, because, you know, it's like writing to your congressman, but or whatever, fine, writing to your House of Commons representative. The, you know, in order to lobby for some kind of action. That's really what it is. It's simply lobbying God. And so the difference between that and the forbidden witchcraft will simply be, is God my authority and is God my basis, or am I seeking something else? And that distinction becomes very important, actually, in our next piece. That's a perfect segue. Because I want to talk about the string as a protection from it. The idea that the string is supposed to protect from witchcraft, thank you, from the evil eye. Yeah, I like to tell the story. I think I probably told it to some of you at one point, of Mr. Schwartz when he's on the stand in court. I remember this one? Mr. Schwartz, you remember, but you've heard it a couple of times. It's still good though, no? Okay. Mr. Schwartz is called in as a witness in court. And the judge says to him, Mr. Schwartz, how old are you? And he says, Kanaina Hara, 76. He gets older every time I tell it, because I'm getting older. And the judge doesn't know what to make of it and says, Mr. Schwartz, how old are you? And he says, Kanaina Hara, 76. And this goes around a few times until finally the Jewish defense lawyer says, you know, has Rachmanis on the judge. He says, you know, Your Honor, let me take care of it. And he says, Mr. Schwartz, Kanaina Hara, how old are you? 76. It is still good. The phrase Kanaina Hara in Yiddish is simply a running together of Hebrew words. Keneged Ayin Hara. Keneged means against. Ayin, eye. Hara, the evil. Against the evil eye. Ken as something that's Ken in Yiddish itself as a negation of works. It's not really Keneged. It's Ken. But don't worry about the etymology. If you want, I can send you in those directions. But the but fundamentally, the idea of trying to avoid an Ayin Hara is just as old as the idea of Ayin Hara itself, and just as much anchored in Jewish tradition. Take a look at source number 13. A passage from the Talmud about refusing gifts. An eye that does not desire to benefit from others' property cannot be affected by an evil eye. You can't hurt me if I never benefit from others. Meaning, if I'm not taking, then there's no reason for people to have animosity towards me. Similarly, not attracting attention. Not attracting the attention of others. One way you can attract the attention of others is if you acquire wealth without effort. People then say, why did he win the lottery? So Talmud discusses a particular case, which I mentioned in number 14, but I should explain it first. You know, normally, within Jewish law, someone passes away, so there's an order of inheritance. There are ways that the wealth is distributed. What happens if somebody converts to Judaism and does not have any children and does not marry? So who's going to inherit their property? What should happen?
The state.
So, you know, in a society like ours, the answer would be the state. right? The state will end up taking it. However, in Jewish society, traditionally, it didn't go to the state. It became hefker. It became ownerless. Whoever claimed it, got it, and that was that. So take a look at source number 14, which asks, what should one do upon acquiring the property of a deceased convert? This person converted, they didn't have any relatives, they didn't marry, they didn't have children. Jewish law is not going to recognize an order of inheritance going back to their family from before they were Jewish. So somebody gets it, but now he is vulnerable to ayin hara. People are going to look at him and say, he just got a windfall, he didn't have to do anything. So he should use it to acquire a Torah. That's what he should do. Use it to acquire a Torah, and that way nobody is going to look at him askance. Rav Sheshet added, the same for a husband who inherits from his wife, meaning that if his wife passes away and there's an estate that came in from her family, so also he's gaining something that he didn't work for. This balances towards wives rather than the husbands. The husbands will argue, but he didn't earn it, and therefore also he should be concerned about how people will look at him. Rava added, even one who receives great profit from a business investment. Rav Papa added, even one who finds something. In any case in which you have good fortune that you do not appear to have earned, you have to worry about people looking at you in a certain way. And that leads to number 15, which may be familiar to you. Traditionally, in a shul, in a synagogue, you don't call up siblings to the Torah consecutively. Parent-child, you don't call them up consecutively to the Torah. Because our practice is that the person who gets the aliyah is up there for their Torah reading. And then when the next person gets called up, what does the previous person do? Doesn't leave. Stays standing up there. Interestingly, you know why that's done. The reason it's done is because the practice today is what happens when someone gets off of the bima after they got an aliyah. What do? They go shake everybody's hand, right? They go, how are you? Whatever. It's been good. I haven't seen you in a while. Why'd you get an aliyah? I didn't get an aliyah. Oh, a set of conversations. So that's a very old practice. That's not new. And so the concern was that the new person gets up to make their blessing on it. The previous person is now making the rounds, and people are talking or whatever. They're not paying attention to the blessing. They're not paying attention to the Torah reading. So what's supposed to happen is you stay up there through the next one. Right when the next one is over, then you step down, and that way you can have your conversations while they're busy calling up the new one and making a mishaberach for the old one and all the things that go on in between. That's the origin of the practice. So the point is that if you have the two siblings standing up there together, you have parent-child standing up there together, everyone looks at them and says, wow, not only have I not gotten an aliyah in like 5 years, but him and his brother. Yeah. So you don't want to arouse that kind of bad feeling. Or not even, I should say, it's not even a political thing necessarily. It could be a painful situation. What if somebody, it certainly happens, isn't able to have kids? And their friends, one after the other, their kids are going up and getting aliyos, and they're standing up there, right? You don't think that causes a little bit of a twinge for the person when they, when they see that? There are all sorts of reasons, why it could cause pain to somebody and cause them to feel bad. So don't show off your good fortune in this way.
So what about when you have a bar mitzvah?
Does that get difficult? That, in all seriousness, then you end up with these situations of, well, we'll call up this one, and then we'll call from that side. Like, we'll call up the mother's father, and then we'll call up the father's father, and then we'll call up, and that way we just manage it all in sequence, effectively. So, what you see here are methods of trying to defeat the jealousy that would lead to the evil eye, but these are all rational, right? There's nothing irrational about any of these suggestions. Don't have good fortune out in public, or if you have good fortune, use it to buy a Torah. Avoid being up there on display in front of the community. But then you get to other practices. And the Talmud records various things that people did that were not in the rational the rational category at all. And the sages were very concerned about these practices. Maimonides weighed in without any hesitation. If you take a look at source number 16, you see what he had to say about this in his Guide of the Perplexed, about these protections from the evil eye and all sorts of what are called segulot, practices that are meant to yield effects that cannot be explained in natural and rational ways. He says, these lies created by early fools were recorded, and the books were brought to good people of soft spirit, fools who lacked a scale with which to know truth from falsehood. They hid these books, they stored them away, which were found then in their estate. And people thought them to be true. In the end, a fool will believe anything. That's Maimonides' take on the supernatural protections from the evil eye. He does not like it at all. He talks about people using the divine name to try to perform miracles. And he says, this is all nonsense. And his fear is where it will go. Because he's concerned, I'm actually going to come back to this in a bit, but he's concerned about what it can lead to for people. Take a look at source number 17. This is a very old source. I've mentioned that the Mishnah was written down as our first outline of Jewish law. Inevitably, if you're going to create a text that summarizes all of the law, there are also going to be the outtakes, right? The things they show during the credits. The things that don't make it into the core text. Sometimes things are omitted from the core text because it's felt they're redundant. You don't really need them in. Sometimes they're omitted from the core text because the canonizers don't have access to them. Sometimes they're omitted from the core text because there are questions about their authenticity. There are all sorts of reasons why something might not make it into the Mishnah. But soon after the Mishnah was concluded, they took some of the outtakes, some of the things that didn't make it into the Mishnah, and included them in a work called the Tosefta. Anybody know what Tosefta means? Additional, exactly. It was added. In fact, it's an appendix, effectively, to the Mishnah. So this piece that I'm quoting you in number 17 is a Tosefta in a volume of the Talmud called Shabbat. It's obviously about practices of Shabbat. You may be familiar with the Torah's prohibition against carrying on Shabbat in a public area, right? And if it's a biblical prohibition, there's nothing I can do about it. But where it's only a rabbinic prohibition in certain areas, then you have an Eruv, and the Eruv encloses the area, and the rabbis created their own solution for the problem they created with the prohibition. I'm not going into that right now. However, the Talmud has a whole discussion about what constitutes transporting something. If I'm wearing a raincoat, but it's not raining, am I transporting the raincoat, or am I wearing the raincoat? The answer is I'm wearing it, and it's not a problem. What if I have a key and I turn my key into a pin? Am I transporting the key or am I wearing it as an ornament? Maybe, maybe not. What if I have a handkerchief and I put the handkerchief in my collar because I want a handkerchief where I'm going? Am I wearing it or am I transporting it? Not so easy, huh? And all of these questions get dealt with. And in the course of this discussion, one of the questions that comes up, what if I'm wearing an amulet? What if I wear an amulet? Now, mind you, the Talmud has very rigorous standards for testing amulets. They actually record. You have to use it three times for the same illness and have it work all three times. It's the equivalent of what in the U.S. is FDA testing, you know, to make sure that it works. They had tests to see. But the question is that if you're wearing an amulet, is it wearing it or is it transporting it? And that leads to the practice of tying a red string around yourself, not necessarily the wrist. So evidently, what that means is that 2,000 years ago, there were Jews tying red strings. But look at what the Tosefta has to say about this. Instead of discussing laws of Shabbat related to the red string, instead it says, Rabban Gamliel, and this is Rabban Gamliel II, I believe, who was in the first century Common Era. He says, this is not an Amorite practice. Who are the Amorites? The Amorites were a nation who lived in Canaan. When the Jews, well, first in the days of Abraham and Sarah, they lived there, but they were there also when the Jews came in under Joshua, and they are considered pagans. believers in ideas that are foreign to Judaism. Rabbi Gamliel says the red string is not an Amorite practice, and therefore what he's saying is it's not prohibited. Leaving aside the Shabbat question, he says it's not considered to be a pagan practice. Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Tzadok, says, you bet it is. He says this is an Amorite practice. This is pagan. This is like idolatry. He doesn't want you using it. And now I bring back Maimonides in source number 18. The practices of the nations, which they considered forces and sigulot, sigulot again being these practices that you can't explain rationally, which lack a scent of idolatry, even practices which lack a scent of idolatry, are prohibited. He says you're not allowed to engage in them. The Torah prohibited all of their practices which are titled Amorite practices, which come to them from idolatry. In other words, going back to Nancy's question, what's the difference between this, preventing the evil eye, or doing the evil eye, and witchcraft? The answer is that the line can be blurry. And there can be debate about a practice like the red string in Jewish texts for a very long time ago. And the debate continues to this day. Take a look, please, at source number 19. Rabbi Moshe Stern, also known as the Debrecina Rav, halachic authority from Hungary, then came to New York in the 20th century, was asked the question, is there a source for tying a red string on a child, carriage, and so on because of the evil eye? Can you tie a red bendle? Well, then don't read the rest. No, just kidding. He says, that was the universal practice. I take universal with a grain of salt. It may have been the universal practice in Hungary, but in any case, that was the universal practice. They were careful to tie a red string on a carriage and crib of a child because of the evil eye. All of these are the practices of elderly women. Now, I read that and think, what Yiddish phrase? Baba Maisa. Right? But that's not the way he uses it. Keep reading. Regarding which Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, a halachic authority called Rashba, wrote that we should not mock their words and practices, for they are certainly founded in the sacred mountains. The mountains means our Masorah, our tradition. He says what they are doing is founded in our tradition, even if we don't know the reasons. So his position was, don't make fun of it. We have respect for them. We don't understand it. We don't perceive what's going on. But we don't assume them to be powerless. And so he says, keep on undoing this red string. Yes, Arlene.
This is my personal opinion.
Yes, okay. Great.
So I think in ancient and medieval times, people didn't understand the natural world. And when they got sick, or floods came, or remotes came, they didn't understand the forces of the force being needed protection. This was many societies. Then when we had the Enlightenment and reason, blah, 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 we thought, we were protected from germs, we didn't worry, war was war, economics, blah, blah, blah. Now, science hasn't answered all the questions. I think people are going back to protection because they don't understand macroeconomics or microeconomics, why you go down, why you lose your job, why one person gets cancer, one is healed, and one dies. There's many things that you don't understand. So whatever
right.
That's what you take.
Right. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And this is where I was going to go with this, is the question of, so where does this leave us when we look at red strings and the resurgence of popularity that it's had over the last several decades? So, to my mind, a lot of it is people's frustration with the inability of science to answer all the questions. Either a lack of faith in it because they saw where science brought society in terms of Holocaust being one example, but by far not the only one. Or simply saying, I don't understand what they're trying to tell me, and I don't think that the answers they're giving me work, because today they tell me that I should eat eggs, and tomorrow they tell me I shouldn't eat eggs, and they tell me I should have red wine, and now they tell me chocolate is good, and now they're telling me about the microbiome, and how all the bacteria that live on me are healthy, and therefore by using antibiotics, I've actually given everybody peanut allergies, and so forth, and you look at the range of contradictory advice that's given, and say, you know what, it's not going to hurt. Like, put on the red string, and maybe that'll, and maybe that will take care of me. And I think that's one piece of it, but it's not the only element. I think it's also because the core concept resonates with people. The idea that jealousy from one person to another can have an effect, not only in terms of motivating them to do bad things to me, but even some kind of supernatural, they're going to pray to God and maybe something can happen to me. I think that has a certain resonance for people, and they're willing to look at it on that level, and that also leads to this. Yes, and then.
Okay, so having discussed all of this,
yeah.
And sort of related to witchcraft, regarding the red string, or even related to God, the difference between belief and superstition.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line?
So, from my perspective, belief is what I do. Superstition is what others do. In all seriousness, something has to be anchored in a logical system. That doesn't mean it has to be proven. And I think that's where belief is different from proof. It needs to have a logic to it where things hold together. It makes predictions about the world that resonate. There is meaning in it. And from my perspective, that is sufficient for it to qualify as belief as opposed to superstition. But I think that it's actually, the question really needs more exploration. I don't think giving a 5-second answer really cuts it. I think this is... Yeah, I think it really is. So something we may have to revisit at a later date. I'm going to take two more comments, and then just note again, I'll be sending out the email later today, God willing, with the flyer for the fall course, and I hope that you're going to participate. But yes, Marlene.
You know, there is the whole concept of aura that can only be done by a woman who learns it before the age of 12, and it's basically a prayer.
Yeah.
To ward off an evil eye, because people can get it unintentionally. You announce a shidduch to somebody who has a daughter who's in the right to get married, they can do it unintentionally. My mother is the go-to person in her community for shrugging looks in the horror.
Wow.
And I have the translation, and it basically asks, you repeat it 7 times, it's a whole thing, but it's basically you're appealing to God. You're not you are not attributing any power to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're just a vehicle for saying please. And then you know what you do at the end of it? You spit in their eyes 3 times.
Okay. You know, up until that last sentence, I was good with it. You know, the truth of the matter is that going back to Talmudic times, spitting in somebody's eye was actually a medical treatment. There's a story with Rabbi Meir, and that idea was there. So I'm not, at the same time, I wouldn't do it. Marilyn.
I just wondered if there was any correlation between when you said wrapping the string around Rachel and wrapping, did it have anything to do with laying tefillin in it? Because you
wrap the tomb. So, I believe that the idea of wrapping it around the tomb is one of those things that they're more or less freestyling with. Like, they're, inventing it in their way. I'm sure that that's where they got it from. Wrapping 7 times has power in this mitzvah, much the same way we talked about with the mezuzah. You take something that is an anchor in Judaism and then spin it a little bit further, and that's what you get. It's 11 o'clock already, so I know there are other questions. I'm going to take questions in the hall if people want, but I want to make sure Rabbi Ziering is going to be able to begin on time. Thank you very much.